1 Samuel tonight. We pick up our story in chapter 17. And we're setting this up by titling this chapter, The Showdown in the Valley of Elah. Now there are 58 verses in this chapter. We're not covering 58 tonight. There's no way that we're going to cover this whole chapter. It's going to take us weeks to get through this chapter, probably at least three or four. Tonight, I'm going to cover three little verses just to kind of set the stage. We're going to basically get the setting or the backdrop. And so I hope that that over the next few weeks that you will be here. And as we unpack this chapter, I hope that you'll learn some things that maybe you have never known before. And I hope that it'll be a blessing to your heart. One of the things that I have learned in the past few years about being a preacher is don't, at least for me personally, don't try to put too much in a sermon. Because sometimes it's just like overeating at a restaurant. After a while, it just gets miserable. And so one of the things that I want us to do over the next few weeks is I want us to take this chapter in bite-sized pieces. Next week, we're going to be introduced to what I'm calling the Bully of Gath. And it's going to give a description of what Goliath looked like. We're going to talk about his armor. But tonight, I want us to just look at the background and see how we got here. Now, we don't really know how much time has elapsed between the end of chapter 16 and the beginning of chapter 17. If you look back at the end of chapter 16, what you find is that there was an evil spirit from God that was upon Saul. David took his harp or his lute, and he played with his hand, so Saul was refreshed. He was well, he got better, and the evil spirit departed from him. And so now we have a little space. We don't know if it's days, we don't know if it's weeks, we don't know if it's months. I'm guessing it's probably the latter. It's probably some months. I do know this. I do know that we are introduced to a group of people that we have been introduced to on numerous occasions. We've talked about them in the book of Samuel as we began preaching out of this book 6 months ago. Now, as we come to chapter 17, we are back with them one more time. The name of this group of people is the Philistines. These were a warring people. They lived along the seacoast of the Mediterranean, and as they began to grow in numbers, they began to expand inland. And it got to the point during this time in the book of Samuel that they lived from the Mediterranean all the way to the Jordan River. We find that they have been battling off and on now literally for decades. We know that at the beginning of Samuel's ministry, when he became a prophet, he was fighting Philistines. If you bounce back over into the book of Judges, you know that Samson fought the Philistines. We are even introduced to the Philistines over in the book of Exodus. And God told Moses, don't take the people through the land of the Philistines, because if you do, the people might get discouraged because that's a warring people. And so we have met these folks on many, many occasions. Now the last time we met them in Samuel was in chapter 13 and 14. And in those chapters they were fighting at a place called Michmash. Well, what happened at Michmash? Well, you have Jonathan, who is the number one general under his dad Saul. He has an armor bearer, and he's tired of his dad sitting under a pomegranate tree doing nothing. So what does he do? He looks at his armor bearer and says, hey, there's a garrison of the Philistines over at Gibeah or Jeba. And so what do we need to do? Let's go over there and confront them. Now remember, the Philistines are now strong. They are skilled in working with iron. They are known for their chariots. Thousands and thousands of chariots. And so Jonathan says to his armor bearer, let's go over to Jeba. Well, as they get there, this is the plan. We're going to be down at the bottom of a ravine. It's a steep ravine. It's a rocky face on both sides. We'll go down one side. We'll get to the bottom, get ready to go up the other side. One side's muddy, one side's thorny. And what we'll do is we'll call up and say, hey, you Philistines up there. And if they say, we'll come down to you, well, then we'll know God's not in it. But if they say, come on up, you want some of us? Come get it. Then we'll know God is in it. So that's what he and his armor bearer do. And he calls, hey, you Philistines up there. Next thing you know, they go, hey, you want some of us? Come on up. You know I'm reading between the lines, okay? But that's basically the story. He goes up. He knocks them down. His armor bearer kills them. He does 20 of them that way. I mean, he Jack Bowers them all, okay? And I mean, there's 20 of them. They're slayed. And now Saul's freaking out, like, what have you done? And so now the Philistines are ticked that their garrison has been attacked and 20 of them have been killed. So they gather at Michmash. And you know what God does? God comes on the scene and God begins to cause an earthquake and they begin to get scared. The Philistines do. They begin to kill one another. All of a sudden the Israelites see what's happening. They start grabbing pitchforks or sticks or anything they can find. They start chasing them. They start beating them and they're killing them until dark. And basically God gave a great victory. And now they're back 27 years later. 27 years it's taken them to regroup their numbers. And so from chapters 13 and 14, now to chapter 17, we know that little less than three decades has now transpired. So with that as a backdrop, I want us to look at our text, verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle. They're not there for a social picnic. No, they're coming back and they're trying to take Israel out again. They were gathered together at Shoko. It belonged to Judah. And pitched between Shoko and Azekah. And I don't even know if I'm halfway pronouncing this right. Ephes Damim. I do know what it means. Basically what it means the Valley of Blood. And the reason that it was given that name is because there were so many battles that had been fought here previously. And there was so much blood that was shed that it was given that name. Verse 2, and Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they pitched by the valley of Elah, and set the battle in array against the Philistines. In other words, they were arranging to fight. And the Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side. And there was a valley between them. That's our passage for tonight. I have stood on one side of that valley. You can visualize this in your mind. As you're looking down that valley, you're high up. You can see and just visualize, and I was on the Philistine side. You could visualize all of those encampments that were all on that hill. Then there's a flat space that's down in the bottom of the valley. And right through the middle is a ravine. You say, well, why would you think the ravine would be that important? Because you remember the Philistines were experts with chariots. But with the ravine there, they couldn't really charge the Israelites. And so perhaps that's why the battle, which we will see in just a few weeks, the battle has been basically a stalemate. There's been a bunch of nothing going on. They're just posturing. It's almost like two sixth grade boys, and they're just kind of walking around looking at each other. Okay? In other words, you know, one of them goes, you hit me first. No, I'm going to hit you. You know, the other one goes, you hit me first, and I'm going to hit you back. And, you know, and they're just posturing. Neither one of them really want to hit anybody. Well, that's what's happening with these guys. You've got one that's over on the Philistine side, and they're down, they're looking down. And then coming up this side, there's another hill. And as you stand there and you look out, you can just visualize on the far side. You say, well, how far is it? It's probably a few hundred yards. You could call to someone, though, and they could hear you on the other side. And so, for 40 days, twice a day, Goliath is going to come in this chapter, and he's going to challenge Saul and the people of God to send out a champion. Now, I don't want to get too far ahead in the story, because tonight we're just setting the stage. But that's basically what is taking place. Now, when you stand on that hill on the Philistine side and you see that mountain, behind that mountain, about 14 miles, is Jerusalem. You can see way back in the background, just a little bit. But do you know about 8 miles this side, or about 6 miles this side of Jerusalem? There's another little place I talked about this morning. It's called Bethlehem. And that's where David lived. And so David, his dad is going to say, son, I want you to take some bread and I want you to take some cheese and I want you to go and I want you to see how the battle's going on. David, being a teenage boy, he's jazzed about that. Well, right now, there is no battle going on. They're just setting up. Now, look at some of the words that are used. Well, if you look at this verse here, you'll see things like this. Gathered together. Pitched. It means they're taking a position. Gathered together again in verse 2. Set the battle in array. The valley between them. So in other words, it's just basically the introduction. I mean, it's just getting you ready for the fight. And it's not going to happen for 40 days. That's exactly where we're at tonight. So what is this little passage got that we can apply to our lives this year? Well, the first thing I want you to look at is this. I want you to notice that we've got to realize that there's a real battle. I don't think that either side, if you look at this, I don't think that either side doubted that at some point there would be a fight. The Philistines wanted a fight. The Israelites probably did not want to fight. But there comes a time when you've got to fight. There comes a time when enough is enough. Well, their numbers have been growing steadily ever since they were decimated 27 years earlier. And so, we've got to realize that there is a battle that's taking place. In our own lives, we've got to realize that there are battles that we're going to have to fight. Now, I never have been, you know, a fighter as such. I was never one to run from one, but I was never one to start one. But But there comes a time when your Christian life, when you've got to stand for something. As a matter of fact, I believe it's over in Corinthians when it says, quit you like men. That doesn't mean quit and not do anything. The old English word for quit means to stand like a man. You got to stand. And there's going to be a battle that comes your way. You say, well, preacher, how do you know that? Because Jesus told us that. Hold your place in 1 Samuel 17, and I want you to go to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, and I want you to see what Jesus said. Look with me at verse 11. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. In other words, there's coming a time when there's going to be a real battle that's going to come against you because Jesus promised that. Now, when that battle comes, the question is this: are we going to be expecting it? I believe that there are Christians that want to live basically like the proverbial ostrich, with their heads buried in the sand. I believe that there are forces at work, even in our own country, that are anti-God. They are anti-Christian. I mean, there are some vile, vile people that want to take a stand against anything that's godly, anything that professes the name God. You know, I remember when it was a really, really big deal when the old atheist Madeleine Murray O'Hare came out about taking prayer out of the schools and taking the Bible out of the schools, and she made such a big deal about that. You know, and man, we got all up in the air. I was just a kid at the time, but we got all up in the air about that. And, you know, and we just ripped Madeleine Murray O'Hare from one end of Savannah to the other. And I'm sure that it probably happened here at the same time in Loganville. But do you know that that same attitude is just as prevalent, if not more so prevalent today? There are people that would still like to take under God out of the Pledge of Allegiance. There's people that would still like to take "In God We Trust" off the money. There's people that would like to take Moses, who is at the Supreme Court building, where he's the center up on that arch. They would love to have him jackhammered off of that. Why? Because they don't want any semblance of religion from this founding of this country to still be prevalent in the 21st century. They are going to revile you. They're going to persecute you. They're going to lie about you. One of the things that young folks ought to learn early, if they're a Christian, somebody's going to lie about you. They're going to say something that's just not so. And you've got to be able to say, Jesus told me that. He told me it was coming. You know, I remember one time we're talking about knowing it's coming. I was just probably maybe a junior in high school. And my dad was always a kind of an antagonistic type person in a gentle way. He was always pulling for me and all that, but then he would want to challenge me. And I don't know, I guess as a junior, I was talking about being able to jump high. And he goes, you can't really jump that high. And I said, Dad, I can jump okay. I can jump pretty good. Now remember, I was a flat belly back then. A lot younger. And about half as big as I am now. And he goes, you can't. I said, Dad, you see that ceiling right there? It was an 8-foot ceiling. He said, yeah. I said, I could touch that with my elbow. And he goes, Dooley, there's no way you can do that. I said, Daddy, I'm telling you, I can do it. He said, well, if you think you can do it, big boy, just do it. I took two steps in the middle of the living room, put my elbow up, and knocked a hole right in the ceiling. He looked at me and he said, you told me you could do it. You know what he did? Put a ceiling fan in. Well, sometimes we've just got to know that it's coming. You got to know it. And we are in a battle. Let me give you a second thing real quick. I want you to know that we've got to recognize that we've got a true enemy. There's no doubt, if you look at this passage, they knew that they didn't like each other. I mean, after all, the Israelites had killed their ancestors. Now, let me ask you a question. If somebody hurt your family years before and they had not sought forgiveness, are you going to like them? Probably not. You know, I mentioned not too long ago about the Hatfields and McCoys. You know, that thing started over a pig. But then it turned into where they were killing one another. And if a Hatfield found a McCoy on their property, they'd just kill him, and vice versa. I mean, they did not like one another. And it was bloody for, I guess, close to 100 years. And finally, after some years passed and some generations kind of got to thinking about it, you know, this thing started over a hog. We're killing people over a hog. And finally, they've decided that, you know, that's just crazy. But these people hated each other. I mean, they wanted to kill the Jews, and the Jews wanted to kill them back. I mean, you kill one of us, we're going to kill two of you. I mean, that was the attitude. Well, who should our enemy be? Can I tell you, right off the rip, it ought not be one another? How many times have we heard of Christians, and they just want to start really with their mouth, their tongue, their lips, they just want to kill another Christian? It could be somebody in their own church. It could be somebody that goes to another church that's a good church. It could be somebody that they don't even know that names the name of the Lord, but yet, what are they doing? They're attacking them. They're attacking them. I read the story, and I don't know what the name of the battle was, but it was during the French-English War. And it was up around Ontario somewhere. And there was an English ship that was coming into one of the harbors. And they were about to go into a battle, and the men thought that it would be fun to begin to shoot at the cathedral that was there in Canada. And all afternoon, they were firing shells, firing cannonballs, firing their muskets, firing everything they could at that church, just for target practice. But then, when it came time for battle, there was a problem. They had no ammunition left. And do you know Christians do that? Man, we'll just fire both barrels at brothers and sisters in Christ. Man, we're going to try our best to take them out. And then when the real battle comes, you got nothing left. There's nothing left. And so, our brothers and sisters ought not be our enemies. We may not dot our I's and cross our T's like they do, but they're not the enemy. Do you remember the story when the disciples came and said, Jesus, you got a bunch of guys over here, and they're preaching in your name. You want us to tell them to shut up? And Jesus said, leave them alone. If they're not against us, then they're for us. It's okay. In other words, it's better to have somebody that is on our side helping us. And just because they're not with our group doesn't mean that we want them to hush. But can I say also that our enemy is not the unsaved? It's not the unsaved. If an unsaved person says something ugly about you, you know why they do that? Because they don't have the Spirit of God in them. You've got to accept they're lost. They're just like you used to be. They haven't been changed yet. And so what do? We try to win them to Christ. We don't hate them. But now I tell you what we do hate. We hate the world, the flesh, and the devil. Let me get you to turn over. Hold your place here. Turn over to 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2. I want you to see how old John is bragging on these people that are newborn ones. And by the way, when he talks about my little children, that's what that means. It means my little born ones, those that have been born into the family of God. There were some of them that were older and some of them that were young men, and they got bragged on. Look at verse 13. I write unto you, fathers, because you've known him that's from the beginning. I write unto you, young men, because you've overcome the wicked one. I write unto you, little children, because you have known the Father. And then he uses those same ones again. He goes, I've written unto you, fathers, because you've known him that is from the beginning. And I've written unto you, young men, because you're strong. And the word of God abides in you. And you've overcome the wicked one. But then check out verse 15. Love not the world. That doesn't mean that you don't love pine trees and oak trees and oceans and beautiful snow. It has the idea of don't love the world system. Don't have their values. Don't accept their habits and the way that they do things. Love not the world. Neither the things that are in the world. And if any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh. Oh, that's real. Apostle Paul said the things that he wanted to do. He said, I have things that the Spirit of God wants me to do, and I just can't do it. My flesh won't always let me. And there are just things that I don't want to do, and I find myself doing that. And it was a battle that was going on. And so the lust of the flesh was a powerful thing. But then, the lust of the eyes. In other words, when you think about things, you look at something and you begin to covet it. Or you lay in your bed with your eyes closed, and in your mind's eye, you begin to plan and you begin to just really see how you can seek out these things that are not godly. I mean, you've got these dreams and aspirations, and they have nothing to do with God. They're 180 degrees from what God wants. And he said the lust of the eyes, and then there's the pride of life. In other words, you know what? I'm special. He said, these aren't of the Father, but they're of the world. And the world passeth away in the lust thereof, but he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. And so there are three enemies. We have the world, we have the flesh, we have the devil. Well, how do we fight them? A few Wednesday nights ago, I touched on this quickly, but I want you to flip over to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians 6. And I want us to just look at this passage for a moment. because it's going to take me as a little segue into my final point of the evening. Verse 10, Ephesians 6, verse 10. Finally, my brethren, these Christians now, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles or the schemes, the deceptive plans of the devil. Why? Because we wrestle not. And this word wrestle is not like WWE. All right? You know, we're not talking about when Hulk Hogan beat Andre the Giant. All right? We're not talking about when those cheating Vachon brothers used to beat the Torres brothers. You say, do you remember that? I went to the wrestling matches all the time as a kid. And those Vachon brothers were cheaters from the first time I saw them. And I love the wrestling matches. And I know it's wrestling, but in South Georgia, it's wrestling. All right? We're wrestling. And so he said, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and against powers, against rulers of the darkness of this world, and against spiritual wickedness in high places. That is the hierarchy in the demonic realm as far as their military rank, I guess would be the best way to say it. And what you've got is you've got sergeants and you've got lieutenants and you've got captains and you've got colonels. But yet here, they're called principalities and powers and rulers of darkness and spiritual wickedness. And why are we wrestling against these, and what are we supposed to do? You take the whole armor of God, that's what you do. Why? That you may be able to withstand in the evil day. In other words, the day's coming. There's going to be a day when Satan and his emissaries begin to pummel you with those fiery darts. And you're going to need that shield to be able to block them. And if one of them gets by, you're going to need that breastplate to be able to not get penetrated. You want to be able to protect yourself with this armor. And when you have stood in that evil day, you've done all, you stand, and then he tells you what that armor is, beginning in verse 14. You have your loins, your middle section, girded about with truth. Nothing lying about you. Straight up truth. No fake news in your life. All right? Straight up truth. You be honest as the day is long. You know that 60 minutes make an hour and 100 cents make a dollar. And if somebody pays you a certain wage, you're willing to work honestly for that. Truth is a big deal in your life. Not only that, having the breastplate of righteousness. In other words, you're trying your best to live right. Why? Because if you're living right, when they begin to shoot those barbs at you, they begin to fire those arrows at you, and they begin to throw those spears at you, they just bounce off. Why? Because the breastplate of righteousness is on. And your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Your feet have a covering over them, hard metal covering, so that nobody could take some type of axe and chop down on it. And all of a sudden, you're hobbled when you're trying to share the gospel with people. And then, taking the shield of faith, the bottom line is you just believe God. If God said it, it's okay. You just have that faith that if God is in the mix, if God is a part of the group, everything's good. And so you've got that shield of faith. And all of a sudden you're looking up in the sky and you got these things coming and they're falling down on you and they're fiery. And all of a sudden you just put that faith up and it's just, and they hit it. But nothing happens to you. Why? You've been protected with that shield of faith. And then, what else? Taking the helmet of salvation. You got a helmet on, and that way the wicked one can't come and knock you in the head and kill you. No, you got protection. You've got that helmet of salvation. Do you know that when sin was dealt with at Calvary, every sin that you ever committed and ever will commit was paid for at Calvary? If it was not the future sins, he'd have to die again. When you got saved, you got saved from your past sins, your present sins, and your future sins. You got saved from the penalty of sin. You are being saved from the power of sin if you're living close and you're trying to put on this armor. But one day, thanks be to God, when we get a glorified body, we'll be saved from the presence of sin. We won't have to worry about what Paul said. Oh, wretched man that I am. We won't have any of that. What we've got is we've got to make sure that we recognize who the true enemy is, and we've got to put on that armor. Now, back to our text. The last thing that I want to touch on is this. You got to be ready at any moment. If you look at the passage, what does it say? It says they're gathered together, they're pitched, they're arranged to fight. And in verse 3, they're standing. Now, as we get into the passage, we're going to find that they're not always standing. But at the beginning, they're ready because they don't know what them jokers on the other side is going to do. So they're ready. They don't want to get caught by surprise. Did you know that in the Roman army, a part of what the Roman soldiers were trained to do was to sleep very lightly and you keep your weapons close by? They didn't really take off their armor a whole lot. They might take it off, you know, once every week or so to get them a bath in a river somewhere. They might take it off if, you know, if they were maybe around a dignitary somewhere, if they were told to. But most of the time, a soldier, especially a Roman soldier, their armor was something that was very, very special. And that armor that we just talked about a few minutes ago, it ought to be special in your life. It ought to be something that you desire to wear all the time. There ought not be a time when you go, well, you know, I don't really think I need this shield of faith much anymore. I don't really need that sword of the Spirit anymore. I don't really need that helmet any longer, that breastplate any longer, or have my loins covered up anymore, or my feet shod. I don't really need to have that anymore. I mean, after all, I mean, I hadn't had to use it now in 3 weeks. Oh, but let me tell you something. Just about the time that you think everything's good, that's when he's coming. That's when he's coming. And so, how do I know that? Rome was the last world empire to rule the known world. They had soldiers that were walking around in all kind of countries that didn't Latin. You had them walking around in Israel during the time of Jesus. And Jesus had a guy that was a part of his disciples that really would like to kill as many of them as he possibly could. The old boy's name was Simon the Zealot. And so these Romans knew that they were walking around in enemy territory. And do you know that you're walking around in enemy territory? This isn't your home. You just pass it through. And so we got to make sure that we're ready. We got to know that there's a battle. We got to recognize that. We got to recognize the true enemy. And then we got to be ready at any moment, because he's coming. It may be after you've had a great victory. I worry about things like that as a pastor. I worry when things go really well for a really long time, because all I'm thinking is the devil's alive, and so we got to be vigilant. Anybody in here quote 1 Peter 5:8? Be sober. Be vigilant. Your adversary, the devil, walketh about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. He's looking to wreck your life. He's looking to wreck these kids' lives. You say, well, he's not getting mine. Well, I hope not. But I'm going to tell you something. There's been a lot of spiritual people that have taken a tumble because they got cocky. They were supposed to be ready, and they weren't. I'm thinking of a man that was in this church. I know he was here 35 years ago. One of the finest, most faithful men that we had. And his wife died. And he decided that he needed to get remarried. And this is not denigrating anybody that would work there, but he met an old gal at a Waffle House. And it wasn't long before they decided to get married. And from the time that he kind of let his guard down and just kind of accepted it because he was lonely a little bit, the rest of his life, he had a lot of sadness. He had things that happened. I could tell you one thing after another, after another, after another. And when I talked to him, he just kind of put his head down. And finally, the old gentleman passed away. And his life could be divided at that one spot. Before and after. Before, happy as a lark. Happy as he could be. But after, without really praying, he stepped into a situation and had nothing but misery for probably the last 15 years of his life. The devil's out there, folks. And just because you're 60 years old don't mean he can't get you. Just because you're 16-year-old, hey, he's looking for you. He's looking for you to do things, young people, that will ruin your life 10 years from now. You better be careful. So tonight, let's learn from what they were doing. They were posturing. They were looking. I guarantee you, when some of them were trying to sleep, they had somebody that was looking across that valley to see if somebody was trying to sneak up on them. They knew that enemy was real, and they had to be ready. Next week, the bully from Gath. Let's stand together.